Hello, and welcome to Sentencing Practice Talk, a podcast for federal sentencing practitioners presented by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. In this episode, my colleagues Lori Baker and Jessica Collins take a deep dive on 5G 1.3. They break down how the court accounts for other terms of imprisonment, how those different sentences interact, what is the BOP's role in the court's decision-making, and much more. Without further ado, here are Lori and Jessica.
Today, I am joined by my colleague, Jessica Collins. She is a senior attorney here in our training division, and this is your very first podcast with us.
It is. I'm excited to join you today.
We're going to talk about a kind of challenging topic that you're going to help us walk through.
This is one that people tend to struggle a little bit with, but hopefully once we get through, we'll give people a good sense of the questions they need to ask themselves. And I think this does break down into some pretty clear rules, which I always enjoy.
I think so, too. So today we are going to talk about Chapter 5, Part G, and specifically 5G 1.3. So in Chapter 5, Part G, we have all kinds of information about how the court needs to impose the sentence. Lots of different rules in there, but the one that seems to cause the most confusion for people live in 5G 1.3. So like you said, there are some rules, and I would agree, they can be confusing. We get a lot of questions on this. And for me, I know if I follow the steps in the book and break it down, you know, mentally in my brain that way, I can manage it. So let's start with talking about what 5G 1.3 addresses.
Yeah, so 5G 1.3 is a little bit different, and I'll just put it in context of like Chapter 5, Part G in general, which, as you mentioned, is all about how to implement the sentence and particularly how to implement the term of imprisonment part of the sentence. So 5G 1.1 and 1.2 are your simpler sort of circumstances where you just have a federal case and you're not worried about kind of anything external, what's happening. What gets confusing about 5G 1.3 or what people tend to struggle with is that's where you're introducing some other term of imprisonment. So someone who is being sentenced in a federal case, maybe they have a state term of imprisonment that they're already serving or they're expecting to serve. Maybe it's another federal case, but this is just trying to figure out how does the court account for or does the court account for that other term of imprisonment when it's imposing the term of imprisonment in this particular federal sentencing?
Okay, so we need to figure out how those two sentences are going to interact, mm-hmm. if they interact at all.
Exactly.
All right. So what's the best way to tackle this?
So before we get into the particular rules of 5G 1.3, it's sometimes helpful to think about some like general concepts that come up that become important. Because before you think about like, what does the federal court do to account for that other sentence? It's helpful to think about, okay, does the federal court make that decision about whether or not, for instance, sentences are going to run consecutively or concurrently? And there's another big actor in this whole space, which is the Bureau of Prisons, right. BOP, right? Which is doing a lot of decision making on its own. And the federal court, as we'll see when we get to the rules of 5G 1.3, needs to think about what is BOP going to do on its own. So before we get to the particular rules of 5G 1.3, we might want to start with just like, what is BOP going to do with whatever sentence it gets?
Right. So some basic pieces to the puzzle that we need before we can even get into applying the rules.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. So first, we'll just start with how is BOP going to handle this sentence, right? It gets a sentence from the federal court. BOP is actually responsible for computing that sentence, for figuring out, for instance, you know, how does that sentence run? How much time is that person serving? And that is determined by statute. And that's really important because sometimes we'll get questions, for instance, on the helpline being like, hey, how can I get the court to tell BOP to credit time that somebody has served? And the answer is you cannot. BOP has to make that decision by statute. And the computation of sentence, that is something that BOP has authority over. The court doesn't have authority over. So the big statute here, it's 18 U.S.C. section Section 3585. There are two subsections there that are important. So subsection A kind of boils down to, when does the sentence actually start? Like, when is BOP going to start counting that time? And it starts either when the person is in custody, awaiting transportation to whatever facility they're going to serve the sentence in, or when they arrive voluntarily at that facility to serve the sentence. What you'll notice there is that sentence does not start before the federal sentencing, right? So it's not while the person is in pretrial detention, you know, getting through the process, waiting for sentencing. It only can start after the sentencing happens.
Right. So we get questions pretty regularly on the helpline or when we're out training, you know, how do I get the court to credit that time someone has served in pretrial custody? And you already said this, the court can't issue that time credit, but BOP is going to potentially account for that time in pretrial detention anyway.
Exactly. So that gets to that second subsection, subsection B of section 3585, which has to do with when BOP will award credit. So it pretty much says that the person will receive credit for time that was spent in official detention under two possible circumstances, either because they were in detention because of the offense for which the sentence is being imposed. And that's kind of the very simple circumstance, right? They go, they appear before the federal magistrate on this charge, they are detained. They can get credit for that time. They can also get credit for time spent in official detention for any other charge for which they were arrested after they committed the offense for which they're being sentenced. But the big caveat to these is that they cannot receive credit if that time is being credited against another sentence. So pretty much really simple thing to boil this down to is if that time in pretrial detention or official custody or official detention is going to some other sentence, it's not going to be credited against their federal sentence.
Right. So I think of that as you can't get credit twice for the same time that you served.
Exactly.
That's the way my brain processes that.
Exactly. Which is different than how things can go running forward, where two sentences can run concurrently. But for time pre-sentencing, there is no credit, or there's no double credit, as you said.
Right. And similarly, if there's time credit out there that isn't even related to this federal case, it's just time that's sitting out there that hasn't been credited to another sentence, that time could come into play in the calculation as well, right? BOP is going to look at all of that.
Exactly. And we see that all the time, right? If you say have someone who is arrested in the state because they have a firearm and then they end up being charged federally, the state dismisses their charge, they're convicted federally, but they spent time in official detention with the state, that time's not being credited toward any state sentence. And so it can be credited. BOP will credit that towards their federal sentence. On the other hand, if they ended up being convicted in the state, that time is credited toward a state sentence, it will not then also be credited toward the federal sentence for all the reasons we've been talking about. There's no double credit to two separate sentences.
So another question we get, I think, relates to what sentence gets served first when there's a state sentence and a federal sentence. Tell me how that works.
Yeah. And so this goes to this question of consecutive versus concurrent sentences. And it really depends on which sovereign has what's called primary custody. So the rule here is that the first sovereign to arrest an individual has primary custody over that person. That sovereign is going to keep primary custody unless and until they relinquish it. Variety of ways that could happen, right? They could dismiss the charges. They could release the person on bail or on parole, or the person could complete their sentences. All those are ways to relinquish primary custody. Important note here, a writ does not relinquish primary custody. So very often someone may be held by the state and they are writted over for their federal proceedings. That writ is not a relinquishment of primary custody. The state would maintain primary custody over that person. And all that is important because the jurisdiction with primary custody, that is the one with the sentence that will be served first. On the other hand, the other jurisdiction is the one that determines whether their sentence then runs consecutively or concurrently or partially concurrently, because really what that boils down to is when that sentence starts running, right? If it starts running immediately at the time of the sentencing, then it can run concurrently. Or it could be set to start at some later date so that it runs either partially concurrently or consecutively. It runs only after that first sentence for the jurisdiction with primary custody has been fully completed.
So I think where that gets really confusing is you're talking about a writ does not relinquish custody, super important piece to the puzzle. But what often happens is I consider a writ that you're basically borrowing somebody for the court proceeding. So defendant is in custody at the state level. The federal authorities basically borrow him from that custody situation, hang on to him until the federal proceedings are finished. But oftentimes that person then is held in a federal facility. The marshals are kind of in control of that piece of custody. So it's really easy to mistake that for being in federal custody. If you see somebody come into the courtroom with the marshals and you know they're being held right now at a federal facility, you think they're in federal custody. So super important that you don't just assume and that you look into what the custody situation actually is.
Exactly. It's not a question of, okay, are they in a federal facility at this point in time or a state facility
housed,
or are the marshals bringing them in? It really is about, okay, which of these jurisdictions has primary custody and they're going to keep that until they relinquish it. So writ does not change who has primary custody.
Yeah, super important step. So have we gotten all the puzzle pieces yet?
I think we've gotten
the
puzzle pieces.
Primary sovereign.
Yeah. Primary custody, we have talked about how BOP is going to compute the sentence, when they're going to award credit for pretrial detention. And then we've talked about our three possible options, right? It can be concurrent, consecutive, partially concurrent, which I think gets us to 5G1.3, which is all about, okay, how do you actually make that decision about which way the court should impose the sentence to run?
Right. And most of the rules, I think, are pretty straightforward. The one that we want to focus on that is the most confusing is 5G1.3B.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how that one works.
Okay. So 5G1.3B, and let me just say 5G1.3, this is having to do with undischarged sentences and anticipated sentences in general. 5G1.3B in particular has to do with undischarged sentences, meaning that person is actually in the process of serving a sentence when they come for their federal sentence. So they've got a sentence, they're serving it currently at the time of federal sentencing. 5G1.3B has two requirements. So first, it's got to be someone that doesn't fall under 5G1.3A, which has to do with offenses that are committed while in prison. So if you've got an offense that's either committed while in prison or while someone has been sentenced and is kind of awaiting going to serve their prison sentence, that's a subsection A. We're not dealing with that here. So we're not an A. And then it has to do with an undischarged sentence that is resulting from an offense that was relevant conduct to the instant offense, either under 1B1.3A1, A2, or A3. Which I'll just say are our kind of main relevant conduct
the
rules,
primary relevant conduct rules.
Acts of the defendant, jointly undertaking criminal activity, expanded relevant conduct, all the harms of those things. So if you have a sentence, an undischarged sentence that is not committed while in prison and is from relevant conduct, 5G1.3B then tells you to do two things. First, to adjust the current sentence that's being imposed to account for time that has already been served on that undischarged sentence. So in effect, you're kind of reducing the time moving forward, or the court is reducing the time moving forward to account for that resentencing detention time, and then to run the sentences concurrently going forward.
So the reason for that adjustment goes back to that you can't be credited twice on the same sentence. So in the situation you're talking about, someone is serving an undischarged term, say at the state level, they're already being credited for that time towards the state sentence, right? So they can't be credited again towards the federal sentence. So that's why that adjustment needs to be made in order to account for that time that won't get credited. Am I right about that?
Exactly. And 5G1.3b actually says, you know, adjust it for time that BOP won't credit. But as we just talked about, BOP is not going to credit time if it's being credited towards some other sentence. So right. If the time is being credited towards the state sentence, BOP won't credit it. The court can't order BOP to credit it, but the court can take it into account by adjusting the sentence.
Right. So I think the easiest example of this that's fairly common is maybe your federal offense is a drug conspiracy. And this individual was convicted at the state level for one of the drug activities that's also part of the conspiracy. And they're serving a sentence right now for that one particular piece of the conspiracy. So relevant conduct under those rules of 1B1.3. So in that situation, we would adjust for time that wouldn't be credited by the BOP, run the remaining federal sentence concurrent.
Exactly.
Correct? All right.
And this makes sense, right? Because it's relevant conduct, so the guidelines are going to take that conduct into account when you're calculating your offense level, so it avoids sort of double counting that conduct.
So we get questions about when a mandatory minimum is involved in your federal case. Can you speak to how that could be handled?
Sure. So there are courts that have looked at that interaction between 5G1.3b and mandatory minimums. Not every circuit, but a number of circuits have looked at this. And what they have said is that the court can actually adjust the sentence below the mandatory minimum. So say you have a drug offense in 21 U.S.C. 841 that carries a 5-year mandatory minimum. The person has already served a, like say, a year on a related sentence in the state. It meets all the criteria for 5G1.3b. The court could then adjust that down by 1 year, go below the 5 years, because the idea here is that person is still serving the full mandatory minimum. It's just that it's being adjusted to account for the time that they previously served in the state.
Right. So as long as the total sentence imposed between the adjustment and the remaining time adds up to the mandatory minimum.
Exactly. And what the commission says in the application notes is to make this very clear on the judgment,
right?
Like, list all of these things. Say you're using 5G1.3b, say how much it's being adjusted for, identify the other case that it's being adjusted for, including the docket number, right? It should be crystal clear to BOP what exactly is happening so that you can see, okay, the total amount of the sentence actually is consistent with the mandatory minimum. It's just been adjusted by a certain amount to account for that time that has already been served on that other sentence.
So I said earlier that as long as I keep track of the steps of that process, then I can navigate this pretty well. And those steps are adjust and run the rest concurrent. So as long as you're following the steps that are outlined in 5G1.3b, you will get to the result that you need to get
exactly,
to.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so I think we have walked through 5G1.3b pretty well. You already mentioned A, when someone is serving a term of imprisonment or awaiting service of a term of imprisonment, that's a different rule under A. What are the other remaining rules under 5G1.3 quickly?
Yeah, so two other rules. So subsection C, that is like for anticipated sentences. So the person isn't already serving that sentence, but they're expecting to to be sentenced to a state term of imprisonment. It's the counterpart to 5G 1.3b, so all the same criteria, except instead of an undischarged sentence, you've got an anticipated sentence, and that one just tells you, okay, if you meet those criteria, you run the sentences concurrently going forward. And then the last one, subsection D, so 5G 1.3d, is just a catch-all for any undischarged sentence that doesn't fall within any of the other rules we've been talking about. So, right, you might have something that's like partially relevant conduct or a revocation sentence or something that's unrelated altogether. And that gives the court a lot of discretion. It can choose, should this be concurrent, partially concurrent, consecutive, all of which look at, you know, what is just the reasonable punishment for the instant offense. But really, that's one that's focused on giving the sentencing court discretion.
I called that the court can do whatever it wants, the catch-all provision. Mm-hmm. And it also deals with complex cases, because you will see cases where some of it's relevant conduct, some of it's not. There can be a lot going on in one individual situation that the court has to try to navigate.
Exactly. Or you might have someone who has multiple undischarged sentences, and one's relevant conduct, one's not.
Yep.
And what do you do there? And all of those just fall within that catch-all provision.
Now, what about a discharge term of imprisonment? If someone has already finished serving a term, a sentence that is relevant conduct to the federal case?
Yeah, great point. So 5G 1.3 does not speak to discharged terms of imprisonment. There used to be a downward departure for certain discharged terms of imprisonment. Obviously, with the simplification amendment that happened last year, all of the downward departures, including that one, were eliminated. So no more downward departure. It points out in the application note that a court can consider whether to vary, just using its authority under the 3553A factors to take into account that discharge term of imprisonment.
So basically, anything that could have been handled by departure previously can still be handled by the court just by way of variance under 3553A.
Exactly.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I think we have covered all of the sections. I know we have some great resources on our website. We have a decision tree that'll walk through some of this stuff that can be very helpful. We have an Adobe Connect program that you can reference in our library. And as always, you can call our helpline anytime. We are always here to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for being with us today, Jessica.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sentencing Practice Talk. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't already to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify to stay up to date. If you've got a question for the helpline or want to access any of the resources discussed in this episode, you can find us at ussc.gov. Please be advised that the information provided by Commission staff is offered to assist in understanding and applying the sentencing guidelines. The information does not necessarily represent the official position of the Commission, should not be considered definitive, and is not binding upon the Commission, court, or the parties in any case. This episode was produced and published at taxpayer expense. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.